You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, our guest says rural economies are about a lot more than agriculture, but federal policy doesn't always match up with reality.
First, Scott Pruitt, head of the Environmental Protection Agency, or EPA, dismissed half of the scientists on a key advisory board. The 18-member Board of Scientific Counselors is charged with evaluating the quality of research done by the agency's scientific arm.
And the recent decision from the EPA is being read as a political move by critics. President Trump has directed Pruitt to bring radical change to the agency and roll back Obama-era regulations.
Oliver Millman joins us now. He's the environment reporter for The Guardian U.S., and he's been covering this story. Oliver, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, good to be with you.
Can you walk us through this decision to let go of several board members, more than half? Who got let go and why?
So there's 18 members of this scientific board that advises the EPA on its the science that the agency creates. Essentially, these people span a range of scientific pursuits, such as toxic water, pollution, air quality, climate change, invasive species, all kinds of things that the EPA looks into. The nine members that were let go essentially came to the end of their three-year terms on April 30th, and it was assumed, I think, by pretty much all of them that those terms would be renewed, as is customary. But in fact, they've all been told they will not be renewed, and as a result, this board of scientific advisors is being quite dramatically cut ahead of what's expected to be a kind of quite a radical reshaping of the panel to be more industry-friendly.
Can you tell us more about what the Board of Scientific Counselors does? You named some of the fields that they study, but what is their charge?
Sure. So they don't actually deal with regulation as such. They just deal with the pure science of what the EPA comes up with. The science underpins the EPA's regulation. So they don't decide if a regulation is warranted or not, or if it should go further or should be weakened. They essentially just look at the science behind those decisions. So they will evaluate the science and make sure it's focused on what the EPA is looking to do, whether the quality is of high enough standard, and essentially a kind of peer review process of the EPA science. And these people have drawn from academia mainly. There's one or two industry and state government voices on the panel, but mainly they're from universities, and they provide their kind of support to what the EPA does. And they're treated very much like public servants in that they undergo ethics training and conflict of interest training and so on.
You mentioned that many of them are academics, and some Republicans had been saying that there were too many academics on boards like this, and that in turn, these same academics may be receiving grant funding. Can you talk more about how that concern among Republicans to have an emphasis on academics?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, there's been a kind of longstanding bugbear of Republicans that people in academia, especially when it comes to the issue of climate change, are kind of conflicted in the sense that they support research that or produce research that supports the idea the world is warming due to human action, and that something should be done about that in order to get further research grants and that supports the EPA in terms of regulation of greenhouse gases, for example. So they feel that there's a kind of conflict of interest there. Critics of the kind of decision that is being made here would say, well, if you start putting industry-aligned people in these positions, there's quite a clear conflict of interest there, because the EPA obviously regulates big polluters. If you've got scientists from big polluters who are analysing the science behind the EPA's decisions, obviously there's quite a clear conflict of interest there.
Now, a spokesperson for that agency had said that the EPA wants more agency accountability toward the states and the communities affected by EPA policy. So what does that tell you about perhaps the new direction that the EPA could be taking?
Yeah, well, Scott Pruitt, who's the administrator of the EPA, has called himself an EPA originalist, and he takes that to meaning the EPA should kind of be a kind of backstop, but essentially leave much of the work to the states. So the budget that President Trump oversaw, his budget proposal, involved a huge budget cut to the EPA, about a third of its budget, which would essentially push a lot of the functions of clean, of ensuring clean air and clean water to the states. The states, of course, are kind of underfunded when it comes to environmental protection, don't have the resources to do it, but Scott Pruitt sees it as primarily the state's job to do that. I mean, the federal and state are meant to work hand in hand, but there's very much more of a focus now under this new administration on states looking after the environment, regulations being taken back from industry to promote economic growth. And you see more and more in terms of the EPA's actions, jobs and economic growth and certainty in business. Those are the kind of buzzwords at the moment rather than public health or anything like that.
Now, you mentioned that 9 members of the Scientific Advisory Board were not renewed for another term. What do we know about who might step in to fill those empty roles?
Well, that's a kind of key question, I suppose. The EPA said that there were more people who understand the impact of regulations on the regulated community, which suggests that there'll be scientists and representatives from large industrial-based companies who will be filling those spots. I mean, it could be that there will just be a different set of academics in some regards, but certainly there'll be more industry representation on there, and that throws open the question of what happens when those people are looking at scientific evidence that impacts their companies. There are strong kind of ethics rules the EPA has that would require them to declare that conflict of interest and step aside, but as the chair of the board said to me today, there's a big reputational risk there. If the EPA is seen to not be impartial, if the quality of the scientific advice is seen to be tainted, then that's quite a serious issue for the agency.
Oliver, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much.
That was Oliver Millman. He's the environment reporter for Guardian US, and he was with us to talk about the Environmental Protection Agency's removal of half of the members of its Scientific Advisory Board.
First, when we think about rural America, the first thing that might pop into our heads is a farm of some sort. And that happens on a policy level, too, as a new federal task force on rural economies puts a heavy emphasis on agriculture.
Our next guest says that's missing a big part of the picture. While farming is an important part of the American rural economy, it's not the only game in town. In fact, in most rural counties, agriculture is not the top moneymaker or the source of jobs.
Tim Merrima joins us now. He's editor of the Daily Yonder and vice president of the Center for Rural Strategies. Tim, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for inviting me, Rob.
Well, you wrote about this in a recent piece, and you kind of started with a recent announcement from a presidential advisor on rural strategies. What did you hear that worried you?
Well, this was in connection with the president's rollout of a plan to study what needs to happen in rural America. And the advisor said to the press, the biggest thing going on in rural, the way to kickstart it, is to focus on agriculture because that's the main driver in rural America. And that's just not true. That's what got me.
Yeah, what do we see? You broke this down by rural county. What do we really see when we look at the economies of rural areas?
Well, agriculture is very important. It's regionally dependent. You know, the Midwest has large swaths of what we'd call farm-dependent counties. And the map that I used for my story is a little bit misleading because it only shows the key largest industry going on in that county. So I imagine for Wisconsin, there's a lot of economic activity in agriculture that's not reflected as the dominant one in a county. So that map's a little bit misleading. But generally, you know, the largest employers everywhere are service sectors in insurance and banking and those sorts of things, not agriculture. So when the advisor said this is the key to the rural economy, that got my hackles up.
Yeah, looking at some different rural counties, what are, apart from what you mentioned, the services, we saw a lot in Wisconsin on your map, recreation being the top driver, and some other rural counties it might be manufacturing.
That's right. And in fact, before the recession, the areas of the rural economy, the counties in rural America that were doing a little bit better than the others were these recreation counties, or some other people call them high amenity counties. These are places that are, you know, have extraordinary natural assets and fun things for people to do in the great outdoors. They were doing a little bit better because those industries were picking up, and you see that in Wisconsin to some extent. The northern part of the state has a lot of those counties that show up in red, which in my map is recreation. There's manufacturing, there's ag, there's mining, and then there's public sector, which is everything from school teachers to mayors and whatnot.
What do we get wrong, say, in federal policy on rural America if we focus too much on agriculture, if we go in with the assumption that farming is the driver of rural economies?
Well, I think we're going to see this potentially with the White House panel that was put together to look at what does rural America need. It has all ag-related representation. So by default, you're leaving out about 80% of the rural economy. So it doesn't. No matter how good farms do, that's not going to affect say, a county in eastern Kentucky or someplace in North Georgia that just simply does not have those programs that benefit farmers. They're not applicable there. So we're leaving behind a lot of rural America, and it's not necessary. Everybody does better when rural thrives. You know, cities and country people do better. Everybody does better when farmers do better. But to say that one is the exclusive thing that's going to be the silver bullet for an economy is just not true.
So what would a good rural economic development policy look like? What kind of common, and maybe there's not a one-size-fits-all approach, given the variety you talked about, but what would be a good starting point?
Well, you're absolutely right about the one-size-fits-all. And this is kind of a, this may be, why we think of rural as only agriculture sometimes is that that's a very clear and organized sector, and they know what they want, and they know how to get it, and farm state senators are very much on their side. It's a lot harder to organize around a lot of different industries for rural, and so we don't hear as much about it. The largest part of the USDA budget is for the nutrition program, for the supplemental nutrition program. Next is the ag program, and way down near the bottom is rural development. And that's where there are programs for rural business development. There are grants and loans for power co-ops and telephone co-ops and broadband deployment, housing loans, those sorts of things that are integral to the economy but not agriculture. So a lot of advocates would say we need to do a balance between ag and more of the rural development type activities.
When I think of an urban economy that's too dependent on one sector, I think of, you know, a place like the Detroit region, which is heavily dependent on automobiles. When that economy changed, the whole region suffered. Is there a similar risk with putting all our eggs in the agriculture basket when we're doing rural development?
Well, for a single region, I don't know. Certainly, you know, we're going to see a much smaller income for farmers in the coming year, like half of what it was in 2013, I believe. And that's going to have an impact. And if farming is your major industry or a major industry, then that's that much less money circulating in the economy. Generally, the Midwest may have issues with that, but generally what's going on with agriculture, at least in most places, is that it's a part-time endeavor. It's not the key income. It's not the main income. It's important. Where I grew up, it was dairy, small dairies. You'd think of it as a cow in your barn, probably, compared to Wisconsin, but and tobacco. And that tobacco money was for Christmas, you know, and you had some money to buy presents, and it was about your quality of life. It wasn't about year-round keeping the family together, especially in the later years.
Talking to Tim Merriman now. He's editor of The Daily Yonder. He's vice president of the Center for Rural Strategies. Talking about rural economies, he's worried that at the federal policy level, people are equating rural with just agriculture, just the farming, and missing a lot of what's actually going on in these local economies. And Tim, have we gotten anything right on these things in the past, or has it always been this way? Have we always been too focused on farming in rural counties?
Well, as you know, 15 years ago, I remember a Republican strategist, Bill Greener, saying, "Well, Congress defines rural as three things: agriculture, agriculture, agriculture." So it's not new. It is. We've made a lot of progress, I think, in talking about rural development in the last, since 2000, really. And then the Obama White House had a rural council of cabinet officials that were looking at a variety of issues and programs that included ag, but was also about quality of life and health care and broadband and economic development outside of ag. The thing that's different here is that this new task force, which is going to evaluate whether they need a White House Rural Council or not, is focused only on ag. That's not exactly new, but it is a pronounced departure from what we've seen for the last couple of presidents.
I wanted to key in on a couple of the issues you just brought up there. You mentioned rural broadband. That's been a big issue, a big debate in Wisconsin about how best to bring high-speed internet to rural areas. And that sounds like an example of something that, would help a farm business. It would also help a hotel or a business startup, that sort of thing. Is that the kind of thing you want to see us focus on more, development that would affect all sectors?
Well, if you want to get rural people to agree on something, bring up broadband, because, buddy, everybody will agree on that. They won't agree on the football game, but broadband they will. I think there's a clear need, and people understand it, and it is like having a road was 100 years ago, or having a telephone. You simply, it's not going to ensure that I sell more tomatoes than you do. It just means I can get them to the market. So you can't even play in the game if you don't have broadband. That's how essential that is. You can't apply for a job generally. It's harder to file your taxes. You can't even get your Social Security statement without online access. Literally, you cannot. So it's like the telephone. It's like the water system. It doesn't guarantee success, but you know you're going to be in a bad way without it.
You also mentioned rural health care, and we had a couple state lawmakers on not too long ago trying to tackle that issue. A lot of rural communities with few doctors, no doctors in some key specialties like OBGYN, mental health, big regions with maybe only one or no practitioners in certain areas. How important is that for you for state and federal policies?
Well, hospitals, those rural places that have hospitals now, they'll tell you it's a huge economic driver. You've got all that employment. And so beyond the services that it provides, it's an economic engine. And also, if there is industry that's going to come in, you know, they want a place that has those medical services. It's pretty critical. There are a lot of small hospitals in rural areas at risk. Part of that is from changes in how they're reimbursed through the federal healthcare system. Part of that is just sort of structural stuff that's been going on for a long time. But we read about one closing, and there'll be more, undoubtedly.
And Tim, as we start to wrap up, I wanted to ask your editor of the Daily Yonder. This is my first encounter with your online publication. One of the best names I've encountered. Tell us a little bit about the Daily Yonder and what you're doing there.
Well, we try to cover rural America, which is a big beat. But we cover things that are of interest to rural leaders, rural advocates, rural policymakers, and rural residents. The creator of that name were the founding co-editors, Bill Bishop and Julie Artery, who live down in LaGrange, Texas now. And I will be sure to mention that you like that. I think it's dandy.
Thanks a lot, Tim, for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Rob.
That's Tim Merrima, editor of the Daily Yonder and vice president of the Center for Rural Strategies. We've been talking about the economies of rural America. He's saying, he wrote in a recent piece, it's not just about farming. We've got to pay attention to a lot of other sectors in rural America.
A new exhibit at Green Bay's Neville Public Museum is showcasing the stories, artifacts, and traditions of Northeast Wisconsin's Latino community. Estamos Aquí opened this weekend and aims to connect people with the positive impacts Latinos have had on the region.
David Liddick joins us now. He's a professor emeritus and political scientist in political science at UW Green Bay and a member of the exhibit committee. David, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
And Patricia Aguayo is a teacher at Casa Alba in Green Bay and received a Presidential Award for Excellence in Math and Science Teaching in 2010. Patricia, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And they both join us from our Green Bay studio. David, where did the idea from this exhibit start?
Well, it started about 3 years ago. We had a very small kind of a little exhibit. There was a kind of a talk of committed to doing more. And so that over a period of 3 years, but really working hard over 2 years, is about a dozen of us really coming from Casa Alba and the Latino community that we assembled and started to meet with Neville Museum on a regular basis. And we started throwing out ideas. And it was a terrific is that these ideas actually really were transformed into the exhibit itself.
And David, take us in through the door. What do we see and hear when we go to the exhibit?
This is wonderful because you start with a migrant farm worker's home there, right? It was a cabin, and it's replicated. Originally, when Antonio Saldana was a little boy, 4 years old, he lived there. His parents were migrant crop pickers, and they're picking in Ocano County for the Bond Pickle Company. As their family moved on, Antonio stayed in Green Bay area and is now, he's a teacher now. That started. And so when you enter the exhibit, what you do is that we've replicated the shelter, the home, basically, which it was for the migrant farm workers. And then after that, what you do, you start to get a tour of the experience of the Latinos in Northeast Wisconsin. Emerge with about seven great ideas, and these ideas were really transformed. In other words, one is you get a kind of the evolution and development of the workforce, really beginning with farm work. Going to seasonal farm work. As you know, now the dairy industry is huge, the Latino contribution to the dairy industry, working in factories and now teaching in schools and in professional work.
I'll dig more into what we see in the exhibit. I want to bring Patricia in. Patricia, one aspect of Estamos Aquí is education and language, and you were a teacher in the first bilingual school program in Green Bay. Can you talk about that perspective on this exhibit at the Neville?
Definitely. It's very educational, especially for not just for the Latino community, but the Latino in general. Just to go there and see how Latinos impact in the area of Green Bay in a positive way. Many of us has been working very hard to make a difference in our community, not just in education, but also in the health area. also in translating documents and to make sure that all the information that we are getting from the white community go through our Latino community with comprehension. And a lot of us spend a lot of time going back to school, get our degree, and be with all the requirements that we need to be working in a professional setting, which make us all proud of what we are doing. Obviously, it's a hard situation for some of us, especially when come to this country with very limited English. So they work very hard to improve their language so they can communicate with the community in a positive way.
And this, Patricia, is a bilingual exhibit. Are you hoping that this helps bridge maybe a gap between people in northeastern Wisconsin and Latino members of the community?
Definitely, yeah. It's one of the wonderful ideas to, you know, when I saw that exhibit in both languages, it really made me very proud because we want to reach the Latino community by having the native language in the exhibit for those who are still learning the English language, but also having the English side by side for the English speaking people to compare both languages. And even for our little children who are learning in bilingual programs in the school district, just to have the exhibit in both languages giving a good is powerful. It's respecting the language of the country that we are living as well as the country with we left, our native language.
Talking to Patricia Agia-Guayo and David Littig about an exhibit at Green Bay's Neville Public Museum called Estamos Aquí, looking at the past and present of the Latino community in northeastern Wisconsin. And David, let's look at that history a little bit. Talk a little bit about how long the Latino community has been a presence in northeastern Wisconsin and what areas did they emigrate from?
Well, we start with one of the interesting things is, well, they started back in the 1930s. But really started to, you know, our exhibit really, we have some little data on demographic data, but it really started in terms of permanent residence. You begin in the 1950s. What's interesting is that over today is about northeast Wisconsin. There are over 35,000 Latinos in northeast Wisconsin. And what's the other thing, when we started this exhibit, while there's a predominance of Mexicans, one of the things is, no, they're more than just Mexicans here. And so one of the things we tried to do is go identify and bring in into this exhibit the cultural traditions of Latin Americans, people in Latin Americans. And I think we interviewed and talked to just about from every country except maybe Paraguay. That's the one we didn't get. But we really searched, and we found out that there was Latin American. So that's the great diversity. And that's one of the things that we champion even in the exhibit on language. In other words, there's difference in language, even in Spanish languages, how people relate to one another, how they introduce themselves, how they talk. It's the same objects in one language. It's something totally different from another country in the same Spanish language. So really, when we try to do the diversity, and one of the interesting things is a lot of audio material. And there's a part of the exhibit for every Latin American country. We have three musical selections. And so you have the music and the rhythms and all the things that are popular in every country in Latin America. You can watch three of them. You can listen to three of them. So again, you're increasing what the thing is, a great diversity, and you get a full picture from Latin America in terms of the culture.
And Patricia, David was talking about there some of the culture. You mentioned the music. There are cultural artifacts going through the exhibit. Patricia, what are your favorite kind of examples of Latino culture portrayed in the Green Bay area?
Well, I am from Chile, and when I heard the music going through the exhibition, it really came, you know, tears in my eyes. Because being in Green Bay and listening to music of my country was amazing. And I can imagine other Latino families from different countries when they hear the music, or even the many different, how do you call this, craft that were there, beautiful craft from different countries. It just it's amazing, really. I was so in tears when I saw the way they organized the exhibition and have all these different people from different countries doing so many good things in the community. And many times, you know, they are not recognized and how well they are doing, supporting each other, and not just between Latinos, but supporting the community in a whole.
And David, you mentioned doing interviews with people from all over the Spanish-speaking world, really, here. Were there common themes you heard from people about what it means for them to be Latino in Wisconsin?
You know, one of the things that some of the ideas, one of the things that really touched me very deeply was, you know, I interviewed 30 people. About the 30 people, and I asked them about their experience in the United States. And we have quotes. There are some 70 quotes that are taken, and you can have an audio and listen to them. But the one theme, I says, what is the theme that's running through them about their experience? A couple of things struck out. One is they found opportunities to advance their education in Green Bay area. In other words, to begin literacy, to get their GED, to go to tech school, to go to the university, and we find that theme really coming out, that they have really, you know, energized their people are trying to advance themselves. The other thing is that one of the things we wanted to keep is kind of a central part of the experience of of being in Latin America in a city. And we wanted something that would embrace all of the different countries and all the people. And we said that the major centerpiece of the exhibit is the plaza. The plaza. It's a place where people intermingle, they talk, they're surrounded. And the plaza is surrounded by artifacts and works of art. For example, a Mexican painter lives here in Green Bay from UWGB, Maura Vasquez. She does these beautiful paintings in acrylics of her children, very large. There's Wenzi Martinez from Oaxaca, a really nationally known textiles. So we have really some wonderful art people who are doing their work, creative artwork, right now in Northeast Wisconsin and contributing at all levels from, you know, this is what's so embracing about this exhibit.
As we wrap up, I wanted to ask each of you about the title of the exhibit, Estamos Aquí, which means we are here. Patricia, what does that mean to you?
It is time to show that we are here, and we are here to do good things. And many of the people in the community working very hard, like finishing their GED, getting a higher education. It is not easy because they have to do it in a language that is not the most easiest language in the world. But they have the energy, they have the ganas, what we say in Spanish. They really want to move forward with their education and contribute to this country and to this community in a positive way. So estamos aquí means we are going to stay here, and I don't think we are leaving from here because we love the city, we love the people around us and the support that we are receiving, and we are ready to do good things.
And David?
Like always.
Well, it's a kind of pride and conviction, you know. That's it. There's so pride of what they're doing here.
We'll leave it there for now. David, thanks for joining us today.
You're welcome.
And Patricia, thanks to you as well.
Thank you.
We've been talking to David Littig, Professor Emeritus of Political Science at UW Green Bay, and Patricia Ejiaquayo, teacher at Green Bay's Hispanic Resource Center. They're with us to talk about Estamos Aquí, an exhibit exploring Latino identity in northeastern Wisconsin. It's open now. It runs through April of next year at the Neville Public Museum in Green Bay.
Coming up, we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. 2017 marks 150 years since Laura Ingalls Wilder was born in Wisconsin. Her story and that of Ma, Pa, Carrie, Mary, and of course her love Manly was a big part of many childhoods.
What about you? Were you a fan of the Little House books growing up? Which one was your favorite? Did you enjoy the stories when they were all young children, or did you like growing up with them? Did you watch the TV show? Are you a devoted fan of Laura Ingalls Wilder and Little House? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. 2017 marks the 150th anniversary of Laura Ingalls Wilder's birth. She was born right here in Wisconsin.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Are you a fan of the Little House on the Prairie books? Did you read them as a kid? Have you shared them with children since you yourself have become an adult? What is it about the books or the TV series that captured your heart, your imagination? You can call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we talked about Laura Ingalls. We've talked about her from time to time on this show. And we talked with an editor of a collection of letters by Laura Ingalls Wilder. And we heard from a caller named Eric from Eau Claire who called in to share this memory.
My dad read all the Laura Ingalls Wilder books to us. We even went on a summer family vacation and hit all the hot spots between here and the Dakotas. Hmm. And for one Christmas, we got a tin cup and an Indian head penny. And that was our Christmas gift. It was the same thing that Laura got when she, I think, was in the big woods. So we got to appreciate how little she got and how great she thought that was.
Oh, that's a great story that Eric shared with us. We still remember that, so it was fun to play that again and remember that. And what about you? Do you have memories like that, life memories built around these Little House on the Prairie books? Are they sentimental to you? Do they mean something? And did you share them with your children or maybe reread them as an adult yourself? You can let us know at 800-642-1234, and you can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we have heard from some people on the Facebook page. Marsha wrote, she says, one of my fondest memories of my childhood is being dropped off at my local public library, finding a cozy spot and sitting for hours reading all the Little House books repeatedly. My parents didn't buy books, so the library or school library were my only sources. Because of that, I bought my own kids loads of books, including the first several in the Little House series. My girls, she writes, never got into them like I did, which is a little disappointed. She says she'll keep reading them and has visited a lot of the historical sites associated with Laura Ingalls Wilder. She concludes, safe to say, I'm a fan.
She sounds like a fan. All right, let's talk to Dave next in Iowa. Dave, hi.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What is your memory of Laura?
Oh, I watched the whole series when my daughters were young, and my sister sold outfits just like theirs. And I visited their home in Burr Oak, Iowa. Hmm. And I got the full box set of all her books, plus the last one that her daughter finished.
Oh, so you're a super fan, Dave. Wow. So you visited the homestead in Iowa, and there is one in Wisconsin, Pepin, right? Mm-hmm. Where you can also visit. We went there, and I think it was closed, but I want to go back. I could see the outside of it. But it's exciting to think that, yeah, it was here in Wisconsin. Well, thank you so much, Dave. Thanks for sharing. You got a lot of memories
of
Little House.
Thank you so much. A lot of people seem to share it among generations, too, like Dave and Marsha. Back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Nancy is with us in Madison. Nancy, hi.
Hi. I knew someone who was devoutly religious and loved the television show so much. It was like in Rain Man, and he would say, 5 minutes to Wapner, 5 minutes to Wapner. She would say, it's time for Little House, it's time for Little House. So she was so enamored of it. She thought it was clean and safe for her grandchildren to watch with her. She knew they were never going to use bad language. When she became elderly and was suffering dementia, she actually prayed for the characters, for the situations in their lives that she remembered from the TV show. And I just don't know of how anybody gets more engrossed in a story than that.
Well, I think people really did, whether it's the books or the TV show, get really connected to the characters. Nancy, were you someone who watched it too?
No.
Not as much.
That saccharine. I was not a fan. I never enjoyed the stories, but I appreciate the fact that other people do.
Gotcha. Nancy, thanks for sharing your neighbor's story at 800-642-1234. Talk about Laura Ingalls Wilder. 150 years of Laura Ingalls Wilder going to be celebrated this year in Wisconsin. This summer, I think there's going to be some big events. You can share your memories of the books or TV show at 800-642-1234.
And I'm also a fan of the TV show. I grew up watching it, and I did. It was a cross-generational thing in my family, too. I would watch it with my mother and my grandparents, and we all got something out of it. I feel like at the end of the series, it got a little dark, and it changed the tone a little bit. But I have such good memories of watching that as a kid. So, yeah, I'm with that. I like the TV show. And here's a comment from Jen on Facebook, who writes, currently sharing my old set of books with my 9-year-old makes me want to take a summer trip to the Ingalls homestead. So, yeah, reliving that with her child. So that's another memory there, sharing these books again. Thank you for that. And you can join Jen. Share your comments, your thoughts at 800-642-1234.
Or, again, post on the Central Time Facebook page. We've got Elliot on the line with us in Delavan. Elliot, hi.
Hello.
What's your experience with Little House on the Prairie and the Laura Ingalls Wilder story?
My daughter and I have bought quite a few of the books from Old World, Wisconsin, up in East Troy. And we've been teaching her to read English parts as far as that goes, and she can read most of the books by herself now.
Wow, and so how old is she, if I may ask?
She's 4.5.
Okay, wow, that's impressive reading for a 4.5-year-old. So
yeah,
how did you do it? You just read along with her?
Pardon?
You just read it along with her?
I started out with reading it to her and then pointing out some of the stuff and some of the words and making her read the words that she could recognize.
Fantastic.
And now she can read the books by herself.
Elliot, thank you so much for sharing that.
And another super quick call here from Ben in La Crosse. Ben, hi.
Hi. Yeah, my mother read me those books when I was little, and I guess Pa Ingalls really had a profound effect on how I viewed fatherhood and what it meant to be a dad, and I guess I carry that with me to this day.
Ben, thank you for sharing that. Yeah, that's Pa Ingalls really was. He was a consummate dad. I know that even Melissa Gilbert on the show thought of him as a dad in the TV show. So there's a lot there. Well, thank you so much, Ben. Thanks to everybody for those calls. And you can keep the conversation going on the Central Time Facebook page.